This is an interview with Emeritus Professor David Craig for the ANU Oral History Project. It's the 11th of April 1991. My name is Stephen Foster. Professor Craig, could we commence by you telling us a little bit about how you came to be a chemist?
I was an undergraduate in science in the University of Sydney, beginning there in 1937, and in the fourth year we had an honours project, and I worked with David Mellor, who was a well-known inorganic chemist in Sydney, and I guess I caught the enthusiasm from him for chemistry as a research subject, and I really continued without diversion. During the war, I did various things, and I worked at one time with Sir Ivan Giffard Mackay, who was a lieutenant general, and he had worked in Cambridge, and he was, oddly enough, he'd been a headmaster as well as a soldier, and he had a great passion for physics, and he gave me some original books of his about James Clerk Maxwell and others, and so it went on. And I never really had any second thoughts. Chemistry, physics, physical chemistry, chemical physics, they were my interests.
How precise was chemistry as a discipline in those early years? Was there a clear distinction between chemistry and physics? And you talk about physical chemistry, chemical physics. Were they one and the same thing, or what were there major differences in approach?
Well, chemistry itself was very well defined as a discipline, as well defined as it is now, I think, and had been for a long time. The more mathematical aspects of chemistry were called both chemical physics and physical chemistry, depending on the bias. You know, you could be essentially using physical methods for chemical problems, or you could use the physics, really, on a chemical basis, but with the physics as your prime interest. Mine was the latter. That was my approach. And you needed the mathematics and you needed the physics, but chemistry provided the systems that you used these methods on.
And was there a strong research orientation in the undergraduate course?
I would not say there was, but the professor of the department was a man named Charles Edward Fawcett, who had grown up in the 19th century in the German school of chemistry. And although he'd given up research himself, he was still a strong proponent of its value in the school of chemistry. And all the staff, I think, were active in research with varying degrees of success. But there was the feeling that you had to be doing research to justify your position on the staff of that school. And that was a very good training ground for people like me, because we grew up with the feeling that what really mattered was the discovery of something new. You had to learn about all this stuff as an undergraduate, but basically you were preparing yourself to find something out. And a good proportion of the students in those years did, I think, go on to some kind of research, perhaps not to the doctorate level, but at least the master's level. You couldn't do a doctorate in Sydney in those days. So there was an inspiration from this old man, Fawcett, even though he'd given up long since himself.
And you went straight on to do an MSc at Sydney, and then there was the interruption of war. Was it an interruption, or did you continue doing the same sorts of things during war service?
No, it was a complete interruption. I didn't think about chemistry at all, apart from reading odd books. No, that was a total break. I came back in 1944, I think it was, and went back to Sydney on the staff then. They were very short of people, of course, to do the teaching, and I got a staff job without trying very hard. I don't know whether I'd get one today. But it was quite easy to be taken on to an academic staff then. And they had these large numbers of students who had to be taught a lot of them returned soldiers, and I knew how to deal with soldiers. And I found it quite easy, whereas some of the others had awful problems. Even I had some odd experiences. There was a chemical society, University of Sydney Chemical Society, of which I became the president. And one night there'd been a meeting, and some disaffected member came out and got one of these fire extinguishers that worked with sulfuric acid calcium carbonate to produce carbon dioxide, and he squirted this thing at me, and it was mainly sulfuric acid, and it burnt my trousers off. And so I had to get round the rest of the night in a lab coat. Not quite burned them off, but I mean it destroyed them. And I pursued this fellow and I caught him, and he eventually agreed to replace the trousers. But they were wild times, and of course there were wild episodes in the lecture courses too in those days, because of this soldiery component, who really weren't all that keen on doing a degree, but they could do it with financial help. So you had all sorts of funny episodes, which I won't delay you with now, but you know, they were very different times.
It didn't discourage you at any rate.
Oh, not at all.
You went then to London.
Yes, I got a fellowship. The ICI and Turner and Newell, two big manufacturers in Britain, offered these research fellowships. And they were the first means, I think, after the war, available to people here to go to Britain. There'd been a very active interchange before the war, mainly from here to there, of course. And that's the scheme under which Birch went, an earlier scheme. But after the war, all that had dried up, and these things were advertised, and a colleague of mine in Sydney, Alan McColl, got the first of them. And then I applied the next year, and I got one too. And later on, oddly enough, Ron Nyholm went under the same banner. And we all chose to go to University College London, which was then one of the most active chemistry schools in Britain. They'd been evacuated during the war to Wales, but had just moved back to London. And we went there and did our various things under a very celebrated English chemist named Christopher Ingold. So the three of us, of whom, of course, two came back, or were due to come back to the RSC, found ourselves working there.
So you were contemporaries. Nyholm, you say, came a little bit later, but you were all at University College at the one time.
We were. Nyholm, I think, was 3 or 4 years older than I. I remember him demonstrating to me in Sydney. He'd have been in his fourth year, and I was in my first. It's about the difference of ages. But we were contemporary, and we were together in London.
And what was your research in London?
Well, I took with me a problem that I'd worked on in Sydney. It was a theoretical problem on the electronic structure of a class of molecule known as aromatic molecules. And so I started that in London. I was able there to get better calculating facilities. We didn't have computers, but we had good calculators. So I could pursue that. And I also started up an experimental program. I can talk to you about computers later if you want to. An experimental program on spectroscopy at very low temperatures. Again, in Sydney, I hadn't had that kind of facility because we didn't have access to very low temperature refrigerants like liquid nitrogen, which is all we had in those days. But in London, they were all there. You know, it was just going to the next lab and getting yourself equipped. So I started on that line, and throughout my working career, carried the two lines together, the experimental spectroscopic studies and the theoretical studies on electronic structure.
Well, you came back to Sydney in 1952. You must have had some misgivings, perhaps, about losing the facility to do that sort of work.
Yes, things were better in 52. Sydney had changed. The Charles Fawcett had retired, and Raymond Lefebvre had come out as head of the school, and they decided to set up a third department. There had always been inorganic and organic departments, so they decided to hive off, as it were, physical chemistry and make a new department, and I was appointed to that foundation chair. Things were much less suitable for my kind of work in Sydney when I got back, but they were improving, and the university gave me some money and I got spectrometers and things like that and set myself up, but it wasn't easy. I did have misgivings about going back, but I was young and it was an attractive idea to be a professor at 31 or whatever it was, and I found that hard to resist. And of course we'd come from Sydney, my wife and I, and we had personal reasons for being happy about returning. But it was a difficult decision.
Was the chair in Sydney in physical and theoretical chemistry established in the knowledge that you were available to take it, do you know?
I think so. I think it was. And of course Birch was back much at the same time, as you will know from your records, and he and I worked in double harness. But I think the chair was established because they thought I might go back to it.
You returned to London in 1956, maintaining the same research interests all the way through?
Yes, but the possibilities of doing them better in London were, of course, enormous. And so I took the same research interests back, but I extended them both in the theoretical and the experimental side. I could now do work on vapor spectra in London because they had a very much better instrument there. So I resumed that side of my spectroscopy. Also, the possibilities of getting low temperatures were much better in London. It's always been a feature of that sort of work that the lower you can get in temperature, the better you're placed. And it's an interesting sideline, really, or sidelight. We were working with liquid hydrogen, very dangerous material, but it was the best that they could offer. We didn't have liquid helium. And this was being made in Cambridge. And we went up, one of my students went up with a great container and got his liquid hydrogen, brought this back on the train, and then we used it. Well, to our alarm, we heard that the whole equipment in Cambridge had blown up. But I don't think anybody was killed, but the whole thing was destroyed. And so we got very alarmed and gave up liquid hydrogen altogether, but I think probably just in time. But we got some useful work done with it. And later on, liquid helium became available, and we used nothing but that. But I essentially did go on with the same kinds of work.
And working with the same colleagues?
No. When I'd been first in London, I was essentially working on my own with a small group of students. And I didn't have anybody whom I worked closely with. I worked under Ingold, who was the head of the department, but he let me choose my own research programs, even at the very beginning. And when I went back as a professor, of course, that was natural and automatic. So I didn't have... the same colleagues were in the department to a large degree, but I didn't have joint programs with them. I did do one piece of work with Ron Nyholm, who we'll talk about later, and with Alan McCall and with a couple of people from Oxford, but broadly speaking, it was just my own research group, PhD students and postdoctorals coming from the US very often. And that's the way research, as you know, is mainly done. You have the group, a pyramidal sort of group, with a group leader and with students and postdocs. But it's pyramidal only in a structural sense. The ideas as often as not come from the students as they do from anybody else. It's a very interesting thing about the way natural science research works, I think.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about that later on. Just in passing, that expression that you used, the group, which of course is a feature of ISC and has been a feature of ISC since its inception, was that a common term, the actual word, in University College?
Oh yes, and elsewhere. I think it is the natural structure for a research operation, the group. I've never believed much in departments in research work. I think that's an unproductive organization. The natural unit is the group, and that group should be responsible for claiming funds and resources on the basis of what it achieves, And that's what we've done in the IRSC, of course. And it was the same pattern in University College. There was there, of course, a giant at the head of it, Ingold. But the rest of us all had our own groups. And we sought our resources with his help from outside bodies and from the college and from the department. But there was no intervening level of structure. Mm. And that attracted me.
We might come back to that in a little while. Mm. But can we move on to your first knowledge of ANU? Can you recall the early discussions relating to the establishment of ANU? Did you have any interest in ANU at the time? Did you note, for example, that there was no provision for, well, let's say a research school of chemical sciences to balance the physical sciences?
My first acquaintance with it, apart from casual conversations over coffee, was in London in my first period there, where I learned that Adrian Albert, who had been appointed to the John Curtin School as, I think, the professor of medical chemistry, and because there were no laboratories in Canberra, he was located at the Wellcome Research Institution in Euston Road. And we were very close at University College, just a 200 metres walk. And I'd known Albert because in my undergraduate period I'd done a research job with him. And so I knew him quite well. So I saw quite a lot of him and learned through him of what the aspirations were of the ANU in medical research particularly. And he was a great enthusiast and a very hard and effective research worker. So that we had a lot in common. And so that was my only significant detailed knowledge of the ANU before I became involved.
And did you like what you heard? Did you like the concept?
Well, I did. I have reservations, as I'll mention later, about the notion of separating research from teaching. But I got the sense from Albert that the operation was being conducted at the very highest research level that was possible in Australia. All the best equipment was available. There were generous means of support of students and co-workers. And I had the feeling that it was giving itself every chance to be a big success in research, so that I was impressed. Mm. And of course, it was beginning to be known, quite apart from personal contacts with people like Albert. There were mentions of it in Nature, which was the, and still is, the sort of popular scientific journal in the UK. So that there was developing the feeling that here was something that was new and probably going to be successful.
How and when did you first hear about the proposals to establish a research school of chemistry?
Well, it was certainly in 1961. My first inkling was a phone call from Hugh Enor, who was Deputy Vice Chancellor, I think, and Director of the John Curtin School at the time. He rang to say that he had something of importance to talk about, and could we meet? And we met in the Express Dairy Cafe on Gower Place, close to Euston Square Tube Station. And it was a pretty sleazy, you know, low-level cafe, much used by the staff of Euston Station. And I can remember it now, we looked at one another across silent pools of coffee left by previous patrons, as P.G. Wodehouse has described it. Pretty ordinary place, but he was eloquent and he was an enthusiastic supporter, and he said that there was this concept that the ANU should develop, the institute should develop a new school for the chemical sciences, that maybe it would embrace existing chemistry in the ANU in the Albert operation, maybe not, that they were anxious to provide, as he put it, I think, a respectable home for Australians who'd worked abroad to come back to. They wanted to stop the brain drain. At that time, as you probably know, the Murray Commission on the Australian Universities had reported in mid-1950s. They'd reported, amongst other things, that the numbers of scientists, particularly chemists in their words, were too small for Australia's needs. And this was one of the impulses clearly behind the NOR, or the university approach. So that was my first contact. I went away to brood on it. I was interested, but I was also heavily committed to University College. I'd only just gone back. I'd gone back in 56, and they'd looked after me splendidly in equipment and all the rest of it. So that I was very reluctant to leave them quickly. But nonetheless, I was attracted, and I'd always hoped I'd come back to Australia anyway. My wife was interested. She wanted to come back if possible. So that was the way it was left, and he'd spoken at the same time on the same trip to Cornforth, Nyholm and Birch. I didn't learn till much later what their reactions were, but we did talk to one another on the phone. Cornforth, Arthur Birch is very good at talking to Cornforth, who's stone deaf. The rest of us, I've never mastered it really. But Birch could communicate very well, so that our contacts with Cornforth were second-hand ones in the case of Nyholm and me. But there was the feeling that we were all interested. But that's about as far as one could have said in 1961, I think.
When Enor spoke to you, did you get the impression that it was very much his baby, ISC?
No, I don't think I got that impression at all. He conveyed it as a message coming from the Vice-Chancellor and Council. It may have been his baby, probably was, but he certainly didn't give that impression. He gave this as a considered point of view of the next developments in the ANU as Council had conceived them. We now know, of course, that Honan was very much a moving spirit. He wouldn't have initiated the idea, but he grasped it in the Honan fashion and ran with it and made the running for a long time. But no, I think Enor was probably convinced himself, but he certainly didn't give the impression that it was his idea.
And you said that he implied that there was a possibility of taking in existing chemistry, Adrian Albert's activities in medical chemistry or in JCSMR. Did that also apply to the faculties? Did he hint at all that that the department in SGS might become allied in some way?
To be honest, I don't remember. But whether he raised it at that time or not, it very quickly came into the discussions, very quickly. We were a bit reluctant on the JCSMR front because, Arthur Birch particularly felt that what Albert did in the chemical the manufacture of drugs by chemical methods and the testing of their effectiveness was really not in harmony with his ideas of what organic chemistry in the research school should be, so that we resisted that with his impulse from the very beginning. Although there was one little group, a subgroup of Albert's empire, which was Frank Dwyer and Alan Sargeson, and there we had a different attitude, but it was all or nothing, really, at that stage. So that we didn't embrace that idea at all, but as I say, the faculty's chemistry quickly came into the picture. And our approach, I think, I must say, was at first that we would use them in a sense, that it would be great to have our own source of research students on the premises. That was not an acceptable view to Hambley, and I'm not a bit surprised. And bit by bit, we retreated from that. And in the end, as you may know, it became policy of the RSC not to accept as graduate students people from the faculties. And we didn't. There was one case, I accepted one, but only because the head of the department at the time said that he'd like me to. So we had this self-denying ordinance, and that ought to come through somewhere. I don't think Hambly remembers that, but it's true. But we soon got the message that it really was unfair and unreasonable to expect them just to be sitting there generating good students or us. It was totally wrong. The business that they would never do research, I don't think was ever a runner. It was our belief that you had to marry teaching and research. So we certainly wouldn't have been saying to them, you can't do any research. Mm. On the contrary, we would be saying to ourselves, we ought to have teaching as well as research. That was the emphasis. And the natural putting into effect of that idea was that we should do some teaching in the faculty department of chemistry. And there were problems on both sides. Our people weren't all that keen, and they were not too keen because their claim to getting more staff would be weakened if it could be shown that they were getting teaching help from us. All that's a little bit later in the story, but I mention it now to give a rounded picture of the way the thing developed. Our relations with Hambly personally were always good, and we saw the point he was making, and I think we did our best to accommodate it.
We might come back to that in a little while. Just still at Euston Road, in that cafe, just dwelling a little on Adrian Albert, did you get the impression at all that Adrian Albert's activities were rather out of place in JCSMR? Did Enor convey that at all?
Again, I can't answer about that particular discussion, but throughout we did get that impression that they felt that somehow he was misplaced. It had been, I think, the concept of Florey, had it been, that there should be medical chemistry in there, and that was the reason why. But later people in that school did not take the same view. And I've heard it again and again over the years that he was out of place there. And not only that, of course, the nature of his work was that he needed a lot of space. He needed a big laboratory with heavy lifting gear and so on. He took up a lot of space in this place, which they felt they could have better used. So that there was always the feeling in the background that he should be somewhere else. But in spite of that, we all know that he did excellent work. It has nothing to do with his work. It's just that the location somehow and the associations were wrong. From his own point of view, he needed to be with other chemists. And from the Curtin point of view, they saw him simply as a service, providing chemical assistance and doing this work on drugs, which they viewed differently from him. So it wasn't a very happy marriage, I don't think.
So you left the cafe, blow by blow, yeah. and you got on the phone to Birch and Nyholm, and presumably you were seeing Nyholm often, constantly, and Birch you were in reasonably frequent communication with.
Yes, well, we had a close association in Sydney, of course, Birch and I, and worked very well together, so that it was natural to talk about this new project frequently. Nyholm I'd known as a personal friend since about 45, I suppose. We used to go on the same bushwalks, a group in which Lionel Murphy was also a member. And so I did know him very well. He was not what I would call a close personal friend. I've written somewhere else that our friendship was not of the sort that would have taken us for a day's fishing together. But it was, you know, mutual respect, I think, and a knowledge of what our sciences were and how our bits of science touch on one another. And so we got on very well. And I'd known him on that sort of footing since 45, as I say, because he was back in Sydney when I went back in 52 to 55, in his case. And then we were both back in London, so our careers marched in parallel over many years.